This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. There's been an enormous increase in the numbers of children diagnosed with autism over the past 2 years, and now public school systems across the country face the challenge of giving them an education. For some autistic children, a specialized, highly intimate education with one-on-one student-teacher interaction may be beneficial, but such schooling is very expensive. Many families simply can't afford it. Public school systems use a variety of approaches. Some have separate facilities for autistic students. Others develop programs to bring them into class with other children, a policy known as mainstreaming or integration. So how do they do it? What's gained? And is anything lost? We want to hear from parents, teachers, and students. What does your school do, and how does it work? 800-989-8255 is our phone number. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org, and you can comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, Weeds, the creator of one of the stranger families on television, joins us. But first, the benefits and drawbacks of mainstreaming children with autism. We begin with Larry Abramson, education correspondent here at NPR. He's with us in Studio 3A. Nice to have you on the program again.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me.
And so what kinds of service? You can't just put autistic children in a classroom. There have to be special services, no?
Right. This is a very big undertaking, particularly when you're dealing with children who are on the more extreme end of what's known as the autism spectrum. Many of these children cannot speak. Some of them cannot respond to verbal instructions. A lot of them use sign language to speak. And they're all very different. That's the other thing that's very challenging about this disorder. So a lot of schools are investing in developing the kind of infrastructure that will allow them to communicate well with these kids in the classroom and also to basically teach them everything that they need to know in order to get along in society. So whereas with a lot of general education or even some special education children, you're trying to teach them academic information. Mm-hmm. Many autistic children need to learn social skills. They need to learn not to hurt themselves. They need to learn not to engage in repetitive behaviors. They need to learn how to basically get through the day without any kind of assistance. And it's a big undertaking for the public schools, but I think a growing number, it's hard to measure, but a lot of schools really are embracing this challenge and seeing that it can be done, but it's a lot of work and it's not just another a group of kids that we're taking in. This is really something on a different order.
On a different order. So what public schools, there's an incentive that they have to do this.
They do have to do this. They are required by federal law, by the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act passed 32 years ago, to educate everybody in this country. And, you know, nobody really disputes this. The question is exactly how many kinds of disabilities they can take on themselves as opposed to those that they have to basically contract out. And there was a time in this country where I think kids who had serious communications problems, who really couldn't speak or had bad behavior problems, they just went to private school. And in a lot of districts, that's still what districts decide to do. We just can't handle it. Or they're concerned about the other kids in the classroom being disrupted.
So we, the public school system, can't handle it. So we will pay a private school to educate these
kids. That's right. And it ends up inevitably costing more to send them outside than it would in the public schools. And for some kids, I think, you know, many parents will say, look, this is still the best thing for my kid. He really can't function in this environment. But there are a huge number of parents who are very insistent on inclusion, the preferred term for that, that say, look, my kid needs to learn social skills. He needs to learn that with other typical kids, with other kids in the general education. I understand that he may not be able to access the entire curriculum the way everybody else will, but he'll get some of it. And the other thing that's interesting about this disorder, I met a boy who's in junior high right now. When he came into the school in Newton, Massachusetts, where I was when he was six, he couldn't speak a word. So he was extremely delayed, several years behind. But through a tremendous amount of effort by a teacher we're going to meet later on in the program and some others in the school system, he now looks like a pretty regular 12-year-old kid. He was reading to a lot of other kids when I was there. He's very charming. He still needs a little bit of help. Nobody could have predicted that when he walked in the door that day when he was 6 years old. But he is reason for hope for those parents of kids who aren't speaking when they should be.
That was a kid named Alex. We heard a clip of tape about him earlier in the program. And Newton, Massachusetts, you may remember a story that Larry Abramson did on this on Morning Edition. Newton, Massachusetts, as you pointed out in that story, is a very prosperous town, and the cost of these programs is not trivial.
That's right. And now, of course, any city in the country gets federal reimbursement for special education costs for dealing with these children, but it is, I don't have the numbers in front of me, I think it's like about 10%. And cities and towns have been complaining for a long time, 30 years, saying that the federal government said they were going to provide at least more of that coverage, but they haven't. And there's no indication that they're going to get they're going to get what it would actually take. And of course, autism is one of the more expensive disorders. I think a lot of schools, though, are looking down the road. They're saying, regardless of why this is happening, it's happening, and it's the right thing to do for us as a community to try to bring these kids into the system and start preparing rather than being surprised every once in a while when one of these kids shows up on our doorsteps.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org, and we'll start with Michelle. Michelle's calling us from Arizona.
Hi, this program is extremely timely for me. My 5-year-old son, after 3 years in developmental preschool, has been mainstreamed into kindergarten in the Peoria Unified School District out here. It's a suburb of Phoenix, and it's an unmitigated disaster. We're on day 7. He is so stressed out that he is acting out. Zach is extremely high-functioning. He is very verbal. In fact, up until last summer, he was actually PDD-NOS, which is pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified, and then last summer he was diagnosed as autistic. And he is acting out in ways. He's bitten 2 children. He just is out of control, and it's because he has absolutely no support in the classroom. They just basically threw him in there, even though everybody who works with him agrees that he needs someone to facilitate social interaction. That's where his severe impairments are, is in communication. Even though he talks, he chatters all the time, he has a hard time with conversation, and he has a hard time understanding. He's got receptive issues.
Right.
And so he's having a hard time interacting with his peers. In fact, he's not. He is so stressed out. He's got sensory issues. And so when we pull into the parking lot, he withdraws into a seat. He tells me very quietly he wants to go home. And then at school, he just is acting out. They put him with a brand new teacher. She said 6 months teaching experience. Peoria does not know what to do with these kids. There were 2 options, a self-contained classroom, which everybody said was wrong for him, and just dumping him into mainstream. He has an IEP, which has support written in it. But the behavioral specialist is split between 3 schools. I don't know what the resource person is doing.
It's Larry Abramson, maybe I can just ask a question, and that is, a lot of situations like this, what happens is that the IEP team, that's the individualized education plan team that's supposed to be working on this child, they often just sit down and say, what can we do to make the situation better? And I recently attended a very interesting training session in Massachusetts where they were actually expanding this team to basically include, the whole school. In other words, that everybody in a school is sort of responsible for everybody's behavior. And they were able to, I saw a kid in a video who had many of the same kinds of issues as your son. And by very carefully plotting out, when does he freak out like this? When does he act out? What, it may seem random, but there are things that are triggering it. They were able to come up with a plan. And, I'll tell you, it was like a before and after, a miracle video. This kid learned how to sit in the classroom by the end of the school year. Has there been any effort to undertake that kind of thing?
Well, we had his IEP last spring. There were literally 15 people there because they knew that I was kind of angling towards getting, if they were going to mainstream, I wanted a behavioral coach or an aide or somebody to facilitate this. And they had 15 people there, I'm not kidding, and including somebody from the district specifically to tell me that they do not do AIDS until the child actually is showing problems in the mainstream environment. Mm-hmm. And then so we have an educational advocate now, and I want her to go in and observe this week, and they're going to have a district personnel there with her observation. And so I've been trying to deal with this since the problems started coming up, and they're all very, very nice in the school district. but nobody does anything. And so I'm going to get a review of IEP. I just need to have documentation. The teacher's frustrated. She's exasperated, doesn't know what to do. And everybody just tells me they want to take some time to study it. And I feel like we're going backwards now. Right. And again, I think it's just Peoria doesn't know what to do with kids as high-functioning as
And clearly, Larry, the overall point that I think Michelle is illustrating for us is some school districts are much better prepared for this than others.
Right. And, of course, the anxiety for the parent is that all the literature will tell you it's extremely important to get in there as early as possible and start teaching these children the skills, the social skills that they need so that they can get by in school. The parent is watching the IEP team, you know, meeting and then meeting months later, and they feel like the child's life is slipping away. And of course, one thing that the federal system, the federal law that provides for disabilities education gives parents is an option, which is to, you know, basically go to mediation, eventually even go to federal court to try to force these schools to provide the kinds of services. It's not a fun process. Anybody who's been through it says that they often the kids are too old to benefit from it. From you know, it comes along too late to really help them. But that is an option. I think that what it also shows is that many school districts don't want to get into this kind of confrontation, and so they're building the infrastructure. They're training their teachers in a way so that they won't have this kind of situation coming up. And they don't build up firm rules saying we don't provide aids. They would instead elucidate, well, what they can try for a child like this.
Michelle, thanks very much for the call, and we wish you and Zach the best of luck.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. And another question that her story, I guess, raises is what's the effect on the other kids in the room? Are their classes disrupted? Is this beneficial for them?
Right. Well, the answer is they can be. They can be severely disruptive and disrupted, and that's why you need teachers who are experienced in how to keep the class going. You need the kinds of aids and additional supports that may cost more in the short term, but in the long term, because you don't end up having to send this child to a private placement, will save money and hopefully lead to a better outcome for the kid, and I think some people would say even for the general ed kids who are around the autistic child.
We'll find out more about what public schools are doing to integrate kids with autism in a moment and talk about what's really best for the kids. You can join the conversation at 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. We'll meet a teacher in just a moment. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Diagnosed cases of autism are on the rise, and it's becoming more common for public schools to teach autistic students themselves rather than send them to special schools. They often integrate autistic students in the classroom. It's called inclusion or mainstreaming, and that's our focus today. You can read more about how public schools are preparing to educate children with autism at our website at npr.org/talk. Our guest is NPR's Larry Abramson, our education correspondent, and joining us now is Robin Fabiano, an inclusion facilitator with the Newton Public Schools in Newton, Massachusetts. She joins us today from the studios of WCAI, our member station in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you.
And the programs in services in the Newton Public Schools, well, Larry described them in his story that some listeners may have heard, but for kids with autism, this seems to be, well, something approaching a gold standard, don't you think?
I think that we do a really great job, and we've had many years of experience to build our program. We started in 1991 with our first student with intensive special needs, and so we've had many, many years to, you know, have trial and error and really make sure that we have good programming and quality control.
And what at this point do you see as the upsides and the downsides of this?
Well, I think the most positive aspect of the overall philosophy of inclusion is that it teaches all students to live and work in a diverse community, which is what the goal of education should be for all students. But for students with autism in particular, public school can bring positive role models in the areas of communication, social skills, appropriate behavior. It also brings a broad and enriching curriculum, which can be motivating for students who have some of those obsessive interests.
Mm-hmm. Downsides, as we heard, classes can be disrupted.
Sure. But I think for those kids that are a little bit more higher functioning, the social anxiety is a huge concern that as they become more aware of their own deficits, it can be isolating for the student to be one of the only students with autism in the class. And I've heard feedback from parents that things like open house, plays, portfolio days are difficult for them because it really highlights the differences between their child and their classmates.
We also know that sometimes kids can be cruel and pick on somebody who's a little different.
That's true, but if students become members of a classroom community in kindergarten, you know, they really begin to understand strengths and weaknesses of each other, and then that cruelty doesn't happen as much.
Mm-hmm. Give us some idea of what a typical day is like for a kid, an autistic child in Newton, Massachusetts. Do they do the exact same programs that the other kids do?
No. In fact, in the school that I work at, we have four students who are on the autism spectrum, and each of their programs is very different because each child is very different, and the support they require is extremely different. We have students that are participating in most of the academic areas with support for more unstructured areas like recess, PE, and things like that. And then we have students that are doing partial ABA discrete trial programs for 20 hours a week and then included in other areas of the day. And then we have students that are included in aspects of the day with very, very modified curriculum. And they all have supports from teaching assistants, and they all have related services such as speech therapy, occupational therapy. And so we really work as a team to make sure that their individual needs are met.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another listener on the line. This is Louise. Louise calling us from Syracuse, New York.
Hi, I'm so excited to be on.
Oh, good.
I'm a teacher. I have had a lot of experience with inclusion. And in my own classroom, I teach science. And if I were to give one piece of advice to a parent who has an autistic child, it would be to pay attention to what other autistic children are in the classroom. I've had a lot of very, very appropriate, productive, bright, just incredible students with an autistic label can be completely sidetracked by other autistic children in the classroom, because part of the first kind of student's disability is distractibility, and they tend to have a hard time with staying focused with the other children that are autistic in the classroom, who are acting out, that are distracted, mm-hmm. distracting. Also, they tend to be grouped together, so they have their own little social thing going on, and they know how to push each other's buttons, and it's entirely possible that the child who could be so enriched by this inclusion program can be really railroaded by those other children that are autistic and, you know, pushing their buttons, for lack of a better phrase to use.
Sure. Robin Fabiano, does that sound familiar to you?
It definitely can happen. I think that the more positive and typical role models are better. I think that kids, if you put seven kids with autism in a class, certainly they would learn inappropriate behaviors because, you know, the inappropriate behaviors are the ones that get the most attention. And so kids learn to get attention, you do what is the most inappropriate. And so I think that if you make sure that kids have typical models, good appropriate role models, high language models, then they'll, you know, they'll raise their own skills.
Louise, thanks very much.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Norm. Norm with us from Whitehall in Michigan.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I'm a high school teacher here in Whitehall, and I teach special education. I've had experience over the years working with autistic and Asperger's students. I love inclusion. It's a fantastic model. The IDEA requires what's called the least restrictive environment, meaning you have to try to place the student in the most inclusive environment possible, and it works very well for most students. I'm a big fan of the model, but of course it does require a lot of cooperation between the parents, the teachers, and the entire staff at the school. That could be accomplished through effective IEP meetings and setting up an individual education plan for each student. But a lot of it, sometimes you wind up having to make a lot of accommodations for the student, and sometimes it requires the student to have a part-time or a full-time aide. And that runs into a money issue for the school districts. The school districts are required by law to pay for these services. And the big issue that I have is that the federal government has failed to fulfill their obligation to fully fund special education according to IDEA. And with the new No Child Left Behind Act in place, they're requiring more special education students, especially in terms of testing and being able to get them to pass the standardized tests that are required. So more and more we're finding that we need to spend more one-on-one time with these students, and of course it requires more staff, which requires more money.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of a comment that I have, but I also have a question. If any of your guests know if there is anything in the works where the federal government is looking to increase their funding for special education, which would really help us out on the local level.
Larry, I guess that's to you.
Well, there is always talk about this, and there's always somebody in Congress who supports this idea, and then there's usually the budget reality, which is that there are many other pressures on the education budget. And so even if the funding goes up, it's just not going to go up very much, I think, if we're talking about it now covering around 10% of the cost of education, and we know that that's just not going to make a big difference for your school district out there in Michigan, and the bulk of the decision about whether or not to hire that extra aide is still going to fall on the shoulders of the taxpayers. And I know just from personal experience is that as well-intentioned as most public school parents are, if they feel like too many resources are going to one kid as opposed to their kid, they're going to resent that to some extent. And I think in this day and age, in some ways, they'll resent it even more because under No Child Left Behind, there's so much pressure on kids to do well. There's pressure on teachers to get them to perform. And there's pressures on students to do well and get into a fabulous college. And no parent wants to think, well, my kid could have learned a little bit more physics if they hadn't been spending so much time on behavioral issues. So it's a tension. You don't hear special ed teachers talk about this too much because I think most of them really want the best for their students. But it's a tension, and I don't think that the federal government is going to come in and ride to the rescue anytime soon.
Hmm. Norm, do you hear any of that resentment?
Well, personally, I haven't heard too much of it at our school. I can see where that would be an issue. What I hear mostly is from the parents of the students that I work with, and they wish that we could provide them with more services.
Sure. I guess everybody wants more.
And I feel very awkward sometimes sitting in an IEP meeting and saying, well, I wish we could do this, but, you know, I'm not sure that, you know, we're going to be able to do that for your student because the class size is big. And it's very frustrating because we just want what's best for kids, and, you know, we try our best with what we have.
Now, Robin Fabiano, Norm raises an interesting point in terms of class size. A lot of school districts around the country, public school districts, class size is a tremendous issue in grade school and all the way into high school.
It's true. And I think in the elementary level where I work, we have managed to keep our class sizes at a pretty good number. However, I would say that the teaching assistants that are there to support the students with special needs are also available to support the other students in the classroom. So there's another benefit for including students who may need extra support. When that student, you know, is working independently, there's another teacher available to support some of the other kids.
Okay, Robin Fabiano, we thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We heard a little bit about that story about Alex. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Robin Fabiano, an inclusion facilitator with the Newton Public Schools in Newton, Massachusetts. She joined us today from the studios of WCAI in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Joining us now is Dr. Margaret Bowman. She's an associate professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. She's also the director of Ladders, a multidisciplinary clinic dedicated to helping those with neurological disorders. She's with us today from WBUR, our member station in Boston, Massachusetts. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
And your clinic, Ladders, works to place autistic children in the right educational setting. How do you determine which school is a good fit?
Not an easy choice for all the reasons that many of your speakers have already talked about. And as Larry and others have said, this is not a one-size-fits-all scenario. In large part, it's through evaluations, multiple evaluations of the children. We often do, I think, as Michelle had suggested in her case, that send someone into the classroom to see what is available in that particular school district and is this a good match for this child or not. If the program is a relatively good match, can it be tweaked a little bit to make it a little bit more appropriate for that child? Have that person go to the educational meeting with the family, because oftentimes I think this is a very difficult thing for families to take on by themselves. And also to provide sort of the credentials and credibility, frankly, to say, yes, I've got experience with teaching children on the autism spectrum. This is what I know about it. And given the child in front of me, this is what I think is probably the best choice right now.
We're talking about education and autism. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And just let me follow up on that bit. I know that you consult with systems in several states, not just up there in Massachusetts. Are programs, if that program in Newton, Massachusetts, for example, is so good, are they worried about a lot of parents saying, I've got a child with autism, I'm moving to Newton, Massachusetts?
Well, it can happen. Frequently, families will move in from other states. This happened a lot during the era when military bases were in this area and military families were moving in. And the frequent question, of course, is just as you've raised it, what are the school systems we should look for? And this is a really difficult situation because in some respects, of course, their school systems are doing a superb job. And I think Newton, by the way, is one of those. And there are other school systems which are doing a less well job. And, you're recommending something which means basically that the school systems that are doing a very good job in some ways pay the penalty for having done a good job because they're likely to be the ones that people will move to because they've got a good school system. And those that are doing not such a good job, well, they might, frankly, get away with doing a lesser job. And it's a sticky issue, I think.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we get another caller on the line. This is Dawn, and Dawn's calling us from New York.
Oh, hi there. Can you hear me?
You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Okay, great. Hi. I just wanted to comment. Thank you very much for taking my call, by the way. I listen to you every day.
Oh, thank you.
I just want to comment. I received custody of my grandson about a year ago, last November. And when he came to us, we were sure that he had autism. And we weren't quite certain. And he didn't speak very well. He was four then. And he had a lot of behavioral issues. And since then, I've had him tested. And just this summer, for 6 weeks, he spent an intense session with a special ed program. And this kid is like a new man. He's like incredible. And he can talk. And now we weren't for sure if he was autistic. They did say he was globally challenged. And he gets... like he got three days of OT, PT, and 2 days of speech. And halfway through the speech process, they suggested that he discontinue it because he was just conversing so well. And this was because of a very determined director of a special ed program in a very tiny town of suburb of Western New York that insisted that this child was going to succeed. And I am, like, so impressed with her insistence so that this child is incredible. I mean, he can communicate when he couldn't communicate a year ago.
I wonder, Dr. Bauman, the stories like Dawn's, we hear them, and they're very encouraging.
Yes, indeed. And I congratulate you. I'm delighted that you have someone like that. Some people just get it, and they really are wonderful advocates for the children, and they figure out how to get the resources to come to bear for those children, and it's a huge success. So congratulations. I hope they'll continue that program, or at least some form of that program. Probably, I'm guessing, because he's little and because those skills are relatively new, they're probably still fragile, frankly. And I'd like to hope that he's going to continue to get some substantial support this next year so that they become a little more solidified and they're his forever. But that's a wonderful story.
He's going to continue with this this learning process until they get him up to snuff, until he goes into kindergarten. And they predict that it won't even take the full year.
Wonderful. Congratulations.
All right.
Thank you.
And thanks, Dawn. And on the other hand, there have to be stories that don't come out so well.
Yes, that's quite true. There is a small, I mean, our expectation in the clinic is that the majority of the children are going to do very well given appropriate services. And for the most part, that's true. And there is a subset of those children who will get to the point where they no longer meet criteria for autism. But on the other end of the spectrum, there also is a small subset of children that no matter what we do, given the intensive services, excellent people, good parents carrying through and so forth, really don't make those gains at all. And as a neurologist, that's the group that I'm particularly interested in because there's a feeling, and I guess I can't say anything more about that at this point, but there's a sense that there's something else going on here that's holding back these children, and it's our obligation from a medical standpoint to try to work through that and see what the problem is and help these families and particularly the kids.
Okay. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Margaret Baumann, an associate professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. Our thanks also to NPR's education correspondent Larry Abramson with us here in Studio 3A. Dr. Baumann was at WBUR in Boston. When we come back, weeds. It's the talk of the nation from NPR News.